Join us every week right here on Progressive Radio Network. And we love bringing you shows here on Progressive Radio Network because, for one thing, they are archived. So if you hear something here today that you like, you can always come back to the archives, visit it again, share it with others, even download it. So we're happy to bring you this information. Today, we have as our guest K.P. Khalsa. And he has a much longer name than that, Kartarpur Singh Khalsa. Yoga Raj. He is a chiropractor as well as being trained in many other aspects of natural medicine. He is one of the country's foremost natural healing experts with over 47 years of experience in alternative medicine. And he is the president emeritus of the American Herbalist Guild and current board member for the National Ayurvedic Medical Association. He mentored with the wonderful Yogi Bhajan for 32 years. Along the way, he incorporated deep studies in both Western and traditional Chinese medicine. And he has his own school that has been training professional Ayurvedic practitioners, nutritional therapists, and herbalists for over 30 years. KP presents at professional conferences and is a prolific author, which includes his book, his well-known book, The Way of Ayurvedic Herbs. He offers in-person and online programs in all aspects of holistic medicine and herbalism. And a wonderful contact is internationalintegrative.com. So thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Nice to be with you.
You're there. I know it's early in the morning for you.
Oh, I'm up early anyway. It's okay.
Oh, that's good. The engineer got you on the line, and I'm happy to hear that. Now, what led you into your path, going back in time? Where did you first feel that you were guided to move into really a spiritual pursuit as well as a natural medicine pursuit?
Oh, this goes way back to when I was in high school, and of course, that was in the turbulent years of the 60s, and people were experimenting with all kinds of alternative lifestyles, different ways of living, different ideas about, politics, morality, everything. And I began to experiment with these sorts of ideas, took yoga classes, meditation classes, that sort of thing. I also had a very serious degenerative illness that was said to be going to leave me incapable of movement by the time I was in my 30s, and then nobody with this disease ever made it past 40. So that was pretty motivating, although at the time I didn't really realize there was anything that could be done. But looking back, I understand that was an underlying motivation for all of this, the wounded healer, as is the case with so many of us.
That is true. Many people seek out healing for themselves and find themselves surrounded by natural medicine as truly the only answer.
Well, that's very true. Very true. There was nothing at all to be done. I was in pain every minute by the time I was in high school, and the teams of orthopedists just said, don't get addicted to morphine too young because you'll need a lot later. And so, I started having symptoms when I was 10. As a 10-year-old, you don't know any different, and that's what they told me. So I was experimenting with these ideas out of interest, out of lifestyle improvement, and then I found that they actually worked very well when conventional medicine had nothing to offer.
Isn't that exciting? Now, I noticed that you used the word in your bio, or whoever sent me your bio, you used the word alternative medicine, but yet now, in terms of how you're representing your excellent knowledge, you're more using the word integrative. What would you say your involvement was to change that kind of definition?
Well, just that natural healing has become much more integrated in conventional medicine, or our understanding. Medical doctors who are younger and who've graduated more recently tend to be open to this. They often have had parents who are my age who have done these sorts of things their entire lives, and it just doesn't seem so alien to them anymore. So all of us in the natural healing field are more inclined to work with conventional practitioners and use the best of both worlds. Now, if we could just get people to communicate effectively and work well as teams, we'd be there.
Absolutely, I totally agree. In fact, my organization is called Natural Alternatives, but we incorporated in, I guess it was like 1980. And at that time, we were thinking about the medicine we're practicing as being alternative. And now, I would say integrative is a nice term. That means bring it all together. And I actually think the best term that was discussed on this show by Dr. Carolyn Dean is the word good medicine. Because the truth is, with the evidence that is coming out in terms of natural therapeutics, it really often is the best medicine, and then there are times when conventional medicine may be more appropriate. So using what's best is really good medicine.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I have nothing against any particular type of medical practice if people choose to use it, if it's working well, and they're fully informed about the consequences. The medical approach for decades has just been suppress the symptom and and move on, and that just doesn't work very well. And now that we have the baby boomers, the first of which just turned 70, getting into some serious trouble, they feel like they're not going to accept that as an answer, and they want they want more attention. Good for Dr. Dean. She's very much an advocate of she's the magnesium expert, of course, and our understanding of magnesium deficiency has been one of the most substantial changes in my practice, that's for sure, over my entire life.
Yeah, Dr. Dean and I worked together because she worked for a while at Dr. Serafina Corsello's, where I was the head nurse for many years. And you had the wonderful fortune to study with Yoga Bhajan, and another colleague that I work closely with is Linda Lancaster, who I'm sure you're familiar with. And she was also involved with Yogi Bhajan for many years.
That's right.
Yeah. And so that's very fortunate in terms of someone of that, depth of understanding crosses your path. And would you believe 32 years go so quickly when you're studying?
Well, the whole situation was pretty unusual at the time. We met when I was a teenager, and he said, you would be good at this Ayurvedic stuff. Do you want to study with me? And I naively said yes, not knowing what getting into an Asian-style apprenticeship was going to be like. But I kept at it, and eventually he had a plan, but the plan continued over those entire 32 years, and there were things that I would ask about, and he would say, when you're a little more mature. I'd say, I'm 50 years old. How much more mature am I going to get? And he said, I have a plan here. And true to his word, he drew the whole thing out over the entire time, and even the last few weeks of his life, he is still teaching things.
So isn't it? Yes, absolutely. And you are really a well-known author who I think has brought a lot of the depth of understanding of Ayurvedic herbs, which we will go back and, what does that word mean? Because you and I are talking about it as if it's an everyday term, but it might not be for everyone. But you wrote a wonderful book, among many other things that you wrote, Ayurvedic Herbs, The Way of Ayurvedic Herbs, which I think is really the most complete guide to natural healing and health with traditional Ayurvedic herbalism, which is a subtitle of the book. But it really brings it to where anyone can use this. You don't have to study with a wonderful guru for 32 years. You have brought it into something that anyone can grasp.
Well, thanks so much. Michael Tierra and I wrote that together. And, of course, Michael Tierra was one of the original rejuvenators of natural medicine of our generation. He wrote a book early in his career called The Way of Herbs. He followed that up a decade later with The Way of Chinese Herbs. And then we together wrote the final herb of the trilogy, The Way of Ayurvedic Herbs. And our idea was to put together this trilogy of books, each focusing on one of what we call the big three, the major natural healing systems, traditional systems, so that people could understand the relationship between them. And that's always been my mission, is to demystify these things. Well, I still use vocabulary from those systems, but I make a point to just speak in clear English so that people understand what's going on. And that's sort of become my trademark over the years, understandable ways to use these things. And you can leave the class today and apply it tomorrow.
Yeah, so that brings it to where people do not have to study. Now, we actually have not defined that word yet. Let's just go back. What is Ayurveda?
Ayurveda is the natural healing system of India, the holistic healing system. It's the same science as yoga. We often call it the sister science, but that's even too far apart. They're the same thing, whereas yoga is the mental and spiritual development side of Indian healing. Ayurveda is the medical side. So Ayurvedic physicians practice and recommend yoga, and yoga teachers practice and recommend Ayurveda. They're one and the same. Ayurveda focuses more on the internal care of your physical body day to day, preventing diseases, maintaining health. So things like herbs, diet, lifestyle, and exercise are all part of Ayurveda.
And it gets deeper. They use gemstone therapy and things that may be considered feng shui. People are familiar with that word in terms of the energetics in a room. It's an extremely deep teaching, but you can jump on board anywhere and just use something from Ayurveda, such as the herbal therapies. And it's an amazing, amazingly ancient, very coordinated and cohesive system of health that I really have been enamored by for many, many years.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's the thing that always impresses me about it, is that I studied natural healing systems from all over the world. And I've been doing this for 47 years now. So over time, I've, taken classes and read books and practiced and mentored with, every system you could imagine. But when I'm sitting across the exam table, eyeball to eyeball with a real sick person, I'm thinking in Ayurvedic terms. It gives me the best holistic understanding of the root causes of their issues and how those have flowered into their symptoms and what we can do to break that cycle and help them heal. You're right. It's a huge system that includes literally anything that would help someone stay healthy, from gross to subtle. Most of the time we talk about herbs and diet, but you mentioned gemstone therapy, and there's certainly breathing exercises and, as you mentioned, the way you organize your house and your life and, how you do what when during your day. And just, it's a huge thing that no one could hope to master in a lifetime. But the beauty of it is that it's all stitched together by a coherent underlying theoretical system, so that you can use one technique and understand how that reflects on another technique.
And so in your life now, you are giving so many online classes, which I have attended many of them. In fact, I do those myself. I do online classes and lectures and workshops all over the country, as you do. And I have a student recently who was studying with me for her American Herbalist Guild certification as a mentee. And it's an interesting girl because she is an esthetist. So her focus is natural skin care. And right at almost, where we have these things that happen together coincidentally, like in my book, Synchronous Connections, I got an email from your school saying you were teaching a course on skin care. So I attended it along with her in terms of the introductory class, and I thought it was so excellent and the perfect thing for her. And she did sign up for the full class and is just loving it. So the fact that we now have online platforms is really expanding the reach that you can have in teaching so much.
Well, that's very kind of you to say about the class. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a dramatic shift. Just over the last couple of years, it's been an avalanche of change. I was just looking at my schedule for the summer a couple days ago and realizing that I wasn't traveling at all. I was traveling the world in my pajamas from my desk. And typically, summer, I'd be gone all summer, one weekend here, one weekend there, doing one thing or another. And now my electrons travel the world. It's really a dramatic change.
Yeah, I think it's a double-edged sword, because I also teach classes in Australia or wherever. It's just amazing. I think I miss, to some extent, the personal contact, but in terms of the increase of breadth of being able to touch people's lives, I would say that's overall positive.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's nice to have human contact and see the whites of their eyes and touch them and smell them, and that would be ideal. Still, there are areas of even the United States where people have difficulty accessing this kind of information. You and I are in kind of hot spots of natural healing. People in the Midwest often just they can't find a natural practitioner within an hour drive of where they live.
That's true. So I'm sure you also, besides giving classes, are able to virtually visit with individuals if they want guidance for their health.
Yeah, it's very true. I was really a holdout for that because, you know, our traditions are all about that close contact, pulse and
touching and smelling and seeing.
Yeah, exactly. I just couldn't figure out how we could do that, but then I just sort of bucked up and tried it, and turns out it works extremely well, so that's what I do now.
As well as giving great classes, and I do want to remind our listeners that you are listening here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and our guest today is K.P. Khalsa. And you can check out all the work that he does at internationalintegrative.com. So, KP, our topic for today as a focus would be clear mind and cognitive deficits. You know, one of the many, many, many topics that can be addressed through the kind of healing that you share. So what would you consider cognitive deficits?
Well, cognitive deficits or impairments, it's a very inclusive term that just describes any kind of impairment in a person's mental process, and it leads to mental processes that lead to acquiring information, knowledge, or how people understand the world. So those would be things like difficulties with attention or making decisions, judgment, language, planning, executive functioning, the kinds of higher order things that we think of as that make us human, and people begin to realize that it's not the forgetting of somebody's name or something like that so much. That happens, but it's things like forgetting where you parked the car and not remembering what you bought at the grocery store, or walking into the kitchen four times and each time forgetting why you came in there. So people write a list, and then they go in and then forget where they put the list, and it goes on and on. We'll talk a little bit more later about how this affects the average aging baby boomer, but the cognitive deficits are something that are very much on the mind of people in natural medicine now, and the future is very bright for these things. We, just in the last 5 years, we've made huge strides with being able to treat these things.
Well, I had a patient this morning who's having what she considers cognitive difficulties as well as sleep difficulties. And one of the things I'm wondering how you feel about it is and it's kind of linked to the fact that we can teach internationally from anywhere, what about all the waves that are in the air now in terms of cell phone towers and smart meters? Do you think those are interfering with A, mental capacity, or B, sleep deprivation?
Well, the short answer is yes, but I'm not quite sure how, and it's hard to get good information about these things. I don't want to jump to conclusions about things that they're automatically bad just because they're new, but there seems to be something about these things that just doesn't seem right, and it's not very rational, really, but it just, on general principles, I'm a little bit skeptical. Here I am looking at a large screen and talking to you over the phone on a wireless handset, and it's, I'm bathed in these things right now. It's hard to get away from them, so I think it's not ideal. I'm not quite sure what we're going to do about it.
Yeah, it's so true. Like I said, it's a double-edged sword, and it's hard to find direct science because, of course, a lot of the studies are defunded, and they, powers that be actually make it pretty difficult to find a one-to-one relationship, but we may see it in changing of migration patterns among birds, other animals, bees, et cetera, as well as perhaps this increased incident of sleep deprivation and cognitive challenges. Of course, it could just be what you're pointing out. Hey, the baby boomer generation, which is a huge group of people, including myself, we're getting older.
Right, and the interesting thing about this change in health patterns in Americans is that it's insidious and slow, so people don't notice that everybody around them is sicker than they used to be. And I can remember when I first started in this business, everybody around me wasn't saying that they were tired all the time, but now 95% of people, when you survey them, say that they have daily fatigue. They can't make it through any given day without a feeling of being too tired to be able to make it. That just was not the case, but it happened so slowly that now everybody thinks that everybody being tired is just the human condition. And, you know, of course it's not. And it goes back to an awful lot of factors, but we're in the perfect storm now where it's noticeable and people are beginning to talk about things like sleep. Even 5 years ago, you know, we didn't see this. So the world is waking up to these ideas, and there are things that we can do.
Well, do you think, or does your research show, that things like memory loss and foggy thinking is a natural part of aging? Is it age-related, or are you seeing this also in younger people?
I'm definitely seeing it in younger people. There's no doubt about that. Younger people are complaining about these sorts of issues. It's not a normal part of aging. It's a typical part of aging, but we all know somebody who is absolutely sharp. I used to use Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Supreme Court Justice, as a great example of someone with a razor-sharp mind who was quite of advanced age. But then, of course, she fell asleep during the State of the Union last year, so maybe she's not the best example.
I'm very fortunate because the people I look up to most in terms of being very useful in their 90s are my parents. They are amazing. And they are, I mean, literally running around. Yesterday I walked down to the beach. I live near the beach here on Long Island. And there they were swimming like every single day. In fact, I know when to find them there because their life revolves around the tide chart. And they actually have a tide chart on their refrigerator so that when it's high tide, they're swimming. You know, just amazing. Running around. My father was showing me the right way to climb steps last night, 92 years old. Do not lean forward, he said, when you climb steps. Keep your back straight. And so you're putting the pressure of the steps in your hips, not on your lower back. I mean, just they are my idols. And they never really studied any of this. They just have always not eaten much. They don't care if it's organic or not. And also never sit down. They're almost never on their butt.
Yeah, I mean, that's just amazing to hear, and it's really encouraging. And so if we, all of us know somebody like that, but most people that we know aren't like that. So we look at what's the difference, and you can start to see, you know, genetics play a role, but increasingly we're becoming aware that genetics play less of a role than we thought. And we used to think it was a straight 50-50 deal. Now a major university announced about 6 months ago that no more than 5% of the diseases that you experience are from your genome, and the rest is from lifestyle factors that have affected the way your genes express.
So right, 5%, that's very low. I mean, even just looking at my parents, they're not related to each other, you know, except by 70 years of being married, that's what they're up to.
But well, sure. Yeah. Well, a lot of it is
certainly
lifestyle.
Certainly different genomes,
that
so that's
that
very
done.
Interesting that you're pointing that out.
Yeah, it's lifestyle is the major factor, as it turns out, and we've just chosen to do a lot of things that didn't work out very well, and we need to change that and then restore the damage of people who are living on donuts and coffee. We've tried that for three generations. It didn't work out very well.
This is so true. Well, we're going to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And when we come back, Dr. Khalsa, we will talk about things like what people can do about it, some of the herbs and natural remedies that can help, and mental exercises, et cetera, in terms of cognitive challenges. So we'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the folklore, history, chemistry, and medicinal applications of the common kitchen herb, thyme.
The common culinary spice known botanically as Thymus vulgaris is only one member of a large genera which includes over 400 species and even more varieties. The Thymus genera is originally native to the Mediterranean region and is a perennial plant which grows wild in usually dry, sandy soil, green heaths, and grasslands. Thyme is a prolific, fragrant, creeping ground cover and often displays an attractive spray of flowering branchlets spanning the spectrum from white to violet.
There is considerable debate amongst historians as to the origin of the name thyme. Some believe it to be from the Greek thymen, meaning to fumigate or to burn a sacrifice, because it was used as a sweet-smelling incense and also to keep pests and venomous creatures away from the Greek home. Others believe it came from the Greek thumos, meaning courage or energy, perhaps because it has a reputation of being used by Greek warriors for courage and was bathed in and used as a beverage for invigoration. The Egyptians used an herb called tham, which we believe is Thymus vulgaris, to mummify their dead. The principal chemical constituents of thyme are the volatile oils consisting of phenol, thymol, and carvacrol. A 1977 article in the scientific journal Chemical Abstracts revealed that thymol's antimicrobial activity is 18 times more powerful than phenol. Phenol is a major antiseptic used in commercial germicidal cleaners like Lysol. Thymol is one of the most potent antimicrobial substances known and far surpasses even the strongest antibiotics. It has been illustrated in the Journal of Chemistry and in the Merck Index of Drugs and Chemicals to destroy parasites, worms, fungi, bacteria, mosquito larvae, and many viruses.
The pharmaceutical and cosmetic industry is privy to the important medicinal effects of oil of Thymus vulgaris. It is ubiquitously found in gargles, cough drops, vapor rubs, and many mouthwashes. Oil of thyme is to be used, albeit very sparingly because of its potency, as a gargle or mouthwash for sore throats and inflamed gums. Because the volatile oil is expelled via the lungs and kidneys, naturopathic physicians use it for upper respiratory infections and urinary tract infections. If you're in the midst of a cold and are lying in bed with too much thyme on your hands, try making a thyme tea made with just a few teaspoons of thyme to a cup of boiling water. It's an excellent diaphoretic because it causes the body to perspire profusely. Thyme also possesses an excellent carminative and antispasmodic effect, helping in poor digestion, flatulence, and intestinal gripe.
So, listeners, if you're feeling ill, thyme heals all wounds. Remember to reach for that thyme in a bottle the next time you open up the natural medicine chest.
From you. We have lots of downloaders of our podcast as well as live listeners. I think we're up to over 200,000 of you that are listening in, and thank you so much for all your feedback. I'd like you to know that you can go to naturalnurse.com. That's all one word, naturalnurse.com. And you can go down to the lower left-hand corner of the front page and just put in your email, nothing else. If you'd like to be on our mailing list, which is product free, it's mostly just information and also tells you about our schedule. You can also go to naturalnurse.com and click on calendar. So some of the things that are coming up right now, we're at the July 4th weekend here on today's show. If you're listening at another time, might be other classes listed there. But right now we have an online herbal certification course and a specific section of that called Using Herbs for Yourself and Your Family. You can take it just as a standalone class or as part three in the herbal certification course. And that is on July 8th. Also, we have our monthly American Herbalist Guild meeting. I'm a registered herbalist with them and involved in the Long Island chapter. And we have a meeting once a month, which is totally free and open to the public. And that one is going to be July 12th. And then we have another online class. Well, first we'll be going to the United States Psychotronic Association National Conference, and I'll be discussing the pineal gland, subtle energy, past, present, and future. And that is a wonderful conference for those of you who love esoteric science. In fact, Linda Lancaster, myself, Dr. Glenn Ryan, and many people, Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher, and many of people who are on the cutting edge of energy medicine in this country and other countries will be there. It's called Psychotronics Emerging Technologies in Consciousness, and that will be in Chicago. If you live in Chicago, you can come in for the day, or of course you can come in and spend the whole weekend with all of us. It'll be definitely an elevating experience. And on July 23rd, we have Sexual Health for Men and Women Naturally, based on my book, The Natural Guide to Great Sex. And that will also, all of these classes have CE credits, 3 CE credits, which are good for nurses, midwives, registered dietitians, clinical nutritionists, acupuncturists, and massage therapists. So if you need credit for your license, you can take our online classes and get credits for that. We also have one called Feeling the Consciousness of Plants coming up on August 13th, and a walk in Chinatown where that's on ground, the walk in Chinatown, where we actually visit traditional Chinese medical apothecaries and have a wonderful day, which is like being in another country. So we certainly would love to see you at any of those events, either virtually or in person. And we'd like to bring back on board our wonderful guest today, KP Khalsa, who is really one of the preeminent leaders in terms of natural medicine. Besides all his other prolific endeavors, he teaches wonderful online courses and is the author, co-author of The Way of Ayurvedic Herbs. He also worked as a senior research scientist and herbalist for many years for Yogi Tea. You're probably familiar with these teas. And he also holds credentials as a state certified dietitian nutritionist, Ayurvedic practitioner, registered herbalist, certified massage therapist, yoga instructor, and the only American to hold the title Yoga Raj in Ayurveda. So we are very, very happy to have him on board with us today. So thank you and welcome back.
Hi, nice to be back.
Now, you are talking about cognitive issues as a focus from the depth of your knowledge and what you think it's related to. And how do you think nutrients and nutrient deficiencies play into things like dementia and memory issues?
I think that this is the most critical aspect in the entire situation. I think that diet is the thing that most Americans have done the worst for the longest, and the thing that's going to have the most profound effect on their overall health of anything that they could do. That said, it's going to take a while because these things don't get corrected immediately. People are so used to instant gratification from drugs. You take ibuprofen, your headache is gone in 15 minutes, and that's what they're expecting from their cognitive deficits. And there is no smoking gun with cognitive deficits. It's a combination of things that have occurred over an extended period of time. So I don't think the idea that our food doesn't have nutrients in it anymore is even up for debate. The USDA statistics show that of 10 key nutrients over the last 50 years, we've lost an average of 50% in the foods that we eat, like carrots, corn, and spinach, very key nutrients. We were discussing magnesium earlier, which is the number one thing people are deficient in, and then our new understanding of vitamin D and things like this. It's very, very clear that people have not gotten what they need to be able to just build the chemicals in their body that help run everything. And the cognitive impairment situation is just part of that. So nutrients, big, big issue.
And, you know, you, of course, as an Ayurvedic practitioner, might analyze what's going on with someone using the body itself, if the body is there and it's not virtual, such as actually things like taking a pulse, looking at the patient, seeing how their skin is. But would you ever recommend doing something like a blood analysis to look at nutrient levels?
Well, of course. And in fact, my credentialing, training, and approach to these things is very, as we were discussing earlier, integrative. So in our nutritional therapy training program, we teach all these kinds of ideas and use modern blood tests. Ayurveda is constantly evolving, and even though we take our cues from things that were happening thousands of years ago, things that haven't changed in the body, we also update that information with things that are being discovered every day. Like, you know, they didn't know about vitamins in Ayurveda. They knew that you had to eat quality food and that certain foods had certain properties, but there was no way to assess something like blood. Now we have that, so of course we use it.
And I know you teach a full course called Nutritional Therapy Program. And is that for patients or practitioners?
Well, that's to train practitioners, yeah. As you said, through my school, we teach many different short courses for the general public, but we also have professional training courses for credentials. So that particular course, Nutritional Therapy, is designed for people who want to go into nutritional counseling as a profession, and it's a course associated with a professional association, much like the American Herbalist Guild you mentioned. People learn how to be nutritional therapists and help people with their diet and supplements.
Now, just you may and you may not know, in terms of the legal ramifications, because some states are making it basically very difficult to call yourself a nutritionist unless you are a registered dietitian.
Well, that's true. There are definitely political battles being fought in various places, and credentialing is a very tough situation, you know, all the way around. I mean, I've been involved in many different discussions of credentialing in all these different professions, and there are always turf battles, and there are legal concerns and competency issues, but yes, dietitians are pushing back on this term in certain states, and it always depends on your particular state. Health matters are regulated by states, so any given situation, people are going to have more or less freedom to talk about these matters.
Yeah, that's what I tell people, to look into the scope of practice that is listed by their state. Now, in this course, you certainly talk about things like assessment techniques in terms of what's going on nutritionally with someone. And then you bring in the Ayurvedic and traditional Chinese medicine aspect as well.
Right. You have to know what's going on to be able to figure out what to suggest. And, you know, one of the diseases of information overload that we have today is that people sort of grab something as being the ultimate explanation for everything. So when I started, it was hypoglycemia, and then it became candida, and we just go on and on, you know, and now it's gluten. And these things are all valid perspectives and probably have some use in natural healing practice at some point. But the idea is to educate people about the specifics and the subtlety and the breadth of these things so that they can really understand what's going on and help people feel better quickly and then also get to the root of the problems. So you have to have some kind of assessment technique. Many times traditional techniques like, as you mentioned, pulse and tongue, give you just an excellent holistic overview of things. But if you want to know if someone specifically has a magnesium deficiency, you have to do specific kinds of blood tests, and you have to learn which of those tests those are and how to interpret them.
Yes, very much so. And that's wonderful that you're able to, you know, teach that both to practitioners as well as use it. One of the beautiful things I think about Ayurveda is that it really individualizes therapy. So while gluten-free, you know, might be important for some people, it may not be for everyone. And then Ayurveda actually looks at the body type of the individual as well as what's going on with the, if we call it an illness or something that, you know, challenge, and what is the weather that day, and what is their house like? I mean, all those things are brought into play, which really individualizes any intervention.
Well, that's the beauty of it, and that's why I am thinking in Ayurvedic terms when I'm dealing with people, because it gives us that understanding from the macro to the micro and figuring out how all these things come together. Ayurveda is very good at figuring out specifics, but it's really even much better at the holistic overview. Why are you having 10 things that all involve inflammation or involve congestion and stagnation or involve lack of proper digestive function? Most people have, you know, one or two or three kind of core issues that have flowered into 10 different symptoms, and they may be treating those 10 symptoms with different techniques, different philosophies, different practitioners, different drugs. The idea is to figure out how all that is related and then handle that over the long term in people's diet and lifestyle. Ayurveda has many, many techniques for that. So the old and the modern is just a beautiful blend of getting us great information, and the kinds of things we can do now in natural healing are just astounding compared to, I mean, every 5 years there's a revolution, and we do things now that we couldn't have even imagined just a few years ago.
That's true. One of the things that comes to mind is when I was part of the Council of Traditional Medicine at Columbia Presbyterian Medical School, and we brought in Vasant Lad, who I'm sure you're familiar with, who's a very well-known Ayurvedic practitioner, and we actually had him do bedside diagnoses using what you described, you know, ancient traditional Ayurvedic techniques, using pulse and tongue diagnosis and looking at the patient and their temperature, all that. And then they did their regular conventional diagnosis and they compared it. And he was about 96% right on, which is actually better than most Western analyses.
Yeah, it's quite amazing the kinds of things that the body can tell you. And once you learn it, it takes a while to learn it and put all this together in your mind, but very valuable.
That was really an exciting project. Now, one of the hot herbs, which has always been used in Ayurveda, but it's very big right now, turmeric or curcumin. It's useful in so many issues. It's amazing. But how does it work with cognitive challenges such as depression and dementia?
Well, this is my favorite herb in the world, and I'm so glad that it's become validated because I really tuned into it when my teacher taught me about it 47 years ago, one of the first herbs to talk about. And at the time, I became a missionary for turmeric, and I would go around and tell people all the things that it did, and it was like, what, that stuff that makes mustard, hot dog mustard yellow, that doesn't do anything. And now it's the most researched substance in human history, amazingly. So turmeric contains numerous healing compounds, and it does well over 100 things that have been established scientifically. Curcumin is the one substance that's gotten all the attention. The story goes like this. If we go back to looking at dementia rates in different countries, scientists discovered that India had one of the lowest dementia rates in the world. Alzheimer's disease is 1/8 in India. That's 1/8 of the American rate of Alzheimer's. And scientists wanted to know, well, why is this happening? And very sort of typically and mechanistically, they looked at the Indian diet and they said, well, what do Indians do that Americans don't do? Or what's different about their life? And I guess I would have said, well, almost everything from, you know, climate to genetics to diet to lifestyle. But they said, oh, that don't they eat that curry stuff? Yeah, it's got that yellow thing in it. I wonder if that's what it could be. So they gave that to some rats. It had some healing potential. This, in again, our reductionist way, we said, well, out of the 10,000 phytochemicals in turmeric, what's the magic bullet that's really doing this? And they came up with curcumin. And from that day forward, all the research was done with curcumin, thousands literally of studies all focused on curcumin. And it looked quite promising, and this turned out to be. We will say that most of the studies on turmeric over the past decade or so, which is when it really heated up, were animal studies, and so we don't have a lot of real solid scientific information about what it's going to do to long-term dementia in people. Some very nice studies over the last couple years on depression, where it showed the study showed curcumin to be as effective as SSRIs like Prozac, but some very profound, promising information about dementia. And there are some studies in progress. When I talk to the researchers, they're just astounded at how well it's working. Those have not been published yet. It takes a long time to research these things. So turmeric contains about 7% of turmeric is dried turmeric is curcumin. That's available as a supplement. You can take that, and we've been using higher and higher doses, and the higher the dose, the better. So curcumin is sort of a, I guess maybe you could call it a green drug. It's an isolated single substance that comes from an herb. It's very, very non-toxic. It does many things, especially including enhancing cognitive processes. But now we're beginning to realize that turmeric has numerous other substances as well. And in the very few studies that have done a head-to-head comparison between curcumin and then turmeric containing the same amount of curcumin, the whole turmeric looked better. The problem is just taking enough, because the doses have to be pretty
well,
high.
Well, that's but interesting. That was my question. What would you recommend? Just using ground turmeric rhizome or a specific capsule that has coumarin? I personally, for myself, I just use the powder. And, you know, I'll cook it a little bit with crushed black peppercorns and either ghee or coconut oil. And I really prefer to use it that way, but a lot of people prefer capsules.
No, I'm exactly with you. I agree completely, and that's what I take it every day in the form of the actual herb. And one way or another, I get in, you know, pretty high doses. It's a question of what you're looking to do. Curcumin is the primary, at least as far as we know, anti-inflammatory constituent in turmeric, and just out of practicality, if you're going to get in a few grams of curcumin to treat some inflammatory condition, including Alzheimer's and the inflammation of the brain, then a curcumin is really the only practical way to do it, because people just won't take the amounts of powder. If they would, I think that probably would be better. We don't have a lot of science around that, but that seems to be the indication. And my general sense over...
Let me back you one minute. What is that amount for a normal, let's say, individual daily that would be recommended?
A couple grams a day of curcumin would be a pretty good dose for a person who might be showing some signs of moderate cognitive issues, something like that. We can certainly go up to, doses go up to 10 grams of curcumin for certain kinds of conditions or for people that actually have active disease. Using it as a spice, the amounts are just unlimited. It's really non-toxic, and you could just use whatever you felt comfortable using.
It's so interesting to me that I notice on some websites they say it hasn't been studied in pregnancy, so don't use it in pregnancy. How many pregnant women in India eat, like, tablespoons of turmeric a day, and there hasn't been an increased incident of any kind of issue?
No, as far as we can tell, that's absolutely true. This is just really a dodge, this whole pregnancy thing, and it's, I think, frustrating to all of us, because the baseline assumption is if something hasn't been studied, we don't know, therefore don't risk it. But, of course, simple spices shouldn't be a problem. Curcumin, however, of course, is 17 times more concentrated than turmeric, so a teaspoon of curcumin would be the amount that it would have occurred in 17 teaspoons of the raw herb. So the idea is just to be especially careful. This extra care in pregnancy is understandable, but kind of bizarre and frustrating for everybody, because it just leaves us with our hands tied. Every single substance, every medicine, every nutrient, every natural remedy, someplace on somebody's website somewhere says don't use during pregnancy, and those websites all network, and so the list is unbelievably long, just multiple pages long of things not to use, and you can just word search it all on the Internet, so when a pregnant woman looks up curcumin, she'll find some website somewhere that says don't use it, and, culinary amounts should be fine.
Well, that's what I would say, too. No one has ever told you don't go to an Asian or Indian restaurant during that period of time. So we're going to take another break right here, and we will come back and continue our discussion with K.P. Khalsa. And you may want to go and look at his website right now. That's internationalintegrative.com, where he features how to get in touch with him, all kinds of really well-done online teaching programs and protocols, as well as in-person virtual visits. Even though he's over there on the West Coast, you can still get to him, the Modern Age Wonders. And we'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
PRN would like to thank its listeners for making us number one on Zeno Radio's phone service and also the top searched internet radio station on Google. Thank you for helping us move forward.
Hello, everyone. I'm Bhavani Jaroff, natural food chef and owner of IE Green, a company dedicated to connecting the dots between the foods we eat, how they are grown, how they impact our environment, and how they affect our health. We celebrate the pleasures around the table, and work to build a sustainable food movement of like-minded people. I'd like to invite you to join my show, I Eat Green with Bhavani, every Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, where I share my recipe of the week, discuss food and environmental policies that affect us all, and interview a leader in the fields of food, health, or the environment. Together, we can work to build a sustainable food movement, one bite at a time. Remember, my show is every Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I hope you can join us.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, a former CIA operative working in Iraq during the war gives it up to create a nonprofit working for peace.
How is this all worth it? What are we doing? You know, what? Look at the impact on these soldiers' lives. Look at the money we're throwing at this. Look at the effort. Look at the fatigue and sleepless nights and danger I'm putting myself into. And for what? What was the point?
Janessa Gans Wilder, our guest next time on Peace Talks Radio.
Progressive Radio Network. The Thinking Person Station.
Once again, right, the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You can listen to any of our podcasts. Get in touch at naturalnurse.com. If you want to get on the newsletter, just go to the bottom left-hand corner and put in just your email, and you'll start getting the newsletter. If you no longer want to get it, it's a very simple opt-out. Today, we have as our guest K.P. Khalsa, very famous in the holistic world, and he has been operating there as a top source of information for 47 years. Those of you who have been listening know that he has a depth of knowledge, and you can find out more at internationalintegrative.com. And we talked about turmeric, which is, you know, basically really buzzing on the news. What are some of the other herbs that you might be that might help specifically with cognitive concerns? I've been very interested lately in bacopa.
Yeah, bacopa is a very famous Ayurvedic herb. It's an herb that grows in swampy, wet kinds of areas, and a lot of good science on that. Herb. It's a little 2-inch-tall plant, sometimes called water hyssop, and people take modest amounts of that every day to just keep their marbles, and then we can use substantially higher doses, maybe 15, 20 grams, something like that, for people that have actual cognitive deficits. Very well-known herb.
Right. It's getting some real play in terms of the research, too. And I find that it does grow in Florida. We can grow it, so I guess it likes warmer weather.
Right. It's very much a tropical plant, absolutely. So I didn't know people were growing it in Florida, but I'm sure it could grow there, yeah.
And have you found any success with using that in terms of cognitive support?
Oh, definitely. You know, there are two herbs in Ayurveda that are both called brahmi, which means godlike. In other words, giving you sort of, you know, supernatural cognitive powers or just extreme abilities there. And the other one is the herb in English that we know of as gota kola. Those are both those herbs are called the same thing, and depending on where you are in Asia, that term will refer to different herbs. So my experience is much more with gota kola, which is really just one of my top five. This herb really delivers. The nice thing about gota kola is that it's culinary as well, which we've been talking about. Bacopa, the one that we discussed a moment ago, is pretty bitter, and really there's not much of a way you can make it into food. But gota kola is a slightly bitter little parsley-type plant that if you think of it as spinach, you know how to cook it, and you can make all kinds of delicious pesto and things like that out of it. So you get that benefit. And then it's used as tea. It's a little milder than bacopa, but that herb just really stupendous for cognitive function, gota kola.
And I wonder, I'm just thinking because I'm working on a presentation about the pineal gland right now, I'm just wondering if it is something that might stimulate the pineal because it does seem to help both with cognitive function while it also it's not a sedative, but it can decrease stress as well.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about it. Both those herbs are very good in that way. Bacopa is colder and more bitter, and so its actions are more sort of limited and specific to the nervous system. Gotocola is a sweeter, less cold and bitter, and has tissue-building kinds of activities. So gotocola not only helps your thinking, but helps to heal nervous tissue. So nerve degenerative diseases like multiple sclerosis, such things, gotocola would be very appropriate, and it helps your memory and things like that. There's a lot less science on gotocola, but the science that's there looks pretty good.
Yeah, and it is, as you said, one of those herbs that you might use ongoingly rather than to treat a... I've been taking it for years, and also I grow that as well. It grows very easily in Florida, and you can just pop it off and chew it, so it makes it really easy. But it has a mild flavor. I don't notice that it's actually a bitter so much, but, it's almost like you said, a vegetable taste. And certainly it's available in capsules and things like that if people prefer.
Yeah, that's right. And most of these herbs that we use in natural medicine are going to be used long-term to help rejuvenate that kind of function. There's not a lot that you can give people that will make an instantaneous difference in their cognition. One that comes pretty close to that, though, is a product called huperzine, which, again, is one of these sort of drug-like, if I could use that term, extracts. It came from a Chinese moss called huperzia. And it turns out that it's extremely active, and we use microgram doses of huperzine. But that's been quite well researched, very generally beneficial for brain health across the board. But that's the most substantial memory aid that I've ever seen in my use of these things. For baby boomers who forget their car keys, the difference is obvious in a week. I mean, they just come in and say, wow, I have the memory of a teenager again. That enhances the function of acetylcholine, which is the main neurotransmitter that our brain uses to make memories and retrieve memories, huperzine.
Well, that is wonderful. I'm going to try it myself. I like to try everything myself, whether I need it or not, because I find I actually develop a signature pattern, and then when I see an individual, it comes to me what might be best for them if I've actually tried it. That's just
beautiful.
A relationship that I have found with natural remedies.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And it just gives you this little signal. Wow. So we are actually at the 2 minutes to the end mark. The time went so quickly. So please share with our listeners a little closing statement and how they can best interact with you.
Yeah, I just want to encourage people that your brain function is something that you need not lose. As Ellen was saying, that we all know people in their 90s who are sharp as can be. And there's some reason for why that happened. And very often it's because they didn't do things that damaged themselves. I was talking about 95% of our health being a result of lifestyle, we know now, and about 30% of that is not smoking. So some really obvious things like that, not eating sugar, not using substances that damage your tissues like alcohol to excess, eating nutrient-dense foods, using the appropriate supplements, huge, huge differences. We're about to see a revolution in this area of treating dementia, according to all my colleagues who work in it, and things like gotocola and huperzine are right on the forefront of that. I do have some handouts for you if you're interested. You can just contact me, and I will shoot them out to you by email. Just go to my website, internationalintegrative, that's just all one word, .com, internationalintegrative.com, and just use the contact tab there and shoot us out some information with your email, and we will pop that right out to you for more detail about these kinds of things that we've been talking about. It's been my pleasure to be here.
Me too, and thank you so much for that generous offer. And listeners, as we go out, I want to tell you, you can get in touch at naturalnurse.com. And until next time, we hope that you stay healthy.